Hello, and welcome to Gilead. I'm Rebecca Anderson, one of the pastors here, and I'm so glad you found us. Specifically, I should say, I'm so glad that when you got in that car crash with your mom when you were a kid, you both survived. I'm so glad that when you made the attempt, it didn't work. I'm so glad you got therapy. I'm so glad that weed is helping. I'm so glad you started swimming. I'm so glad that the cut wasn't deeper and didn't get infected. I'm so glad that treatment worked. I'm so glad you got sober when you did. I'm glad you got on meds. I'm glad I got on meds. I'm so fucking glad that you made it through everything you made it through to be here right now. Punk's not dead, and you're not either. We've all got the scars to prove it. It's Holy Week, Birches. We've spent this Lent telling stories of shit that refused to die, and now we're up against it. The stories of the last week of Jesus' life, when it all started to move faster and faster. The meals, the arrest, the roller coaster that took him and takes us to the cross, and then to be continued. Spoiler, Jesus comes out on the other side, and so sometimes do we. Like us, Jesus does not emerge unscathed from his little project of being human, which you know all about. That was the welcome from Sunday night, April 2nd, 2023. And here's the sermon.
I mean, if there is another church in this entire world that did a better job of singing Back in Black this Palm Sunday, bring it. Bring it. Most of my scars are atrophic. That's a word that I learned this week. So some scars form as a raised thickness. Those are hypertrophic. And they usually stay about the same size as the wound. Some scars grow into a kind of benign tumor, shiny and larger than the original injury. Those are keloid scars, and they're most common in people with darker skin. Stretch marks are scars. Atrophic scars are indented, sunken below the surface of the skin around them, like some acne scars, you know, or ones from chickenpox. They develop when healing happens below the expected layer of skin, when the skin can't regenerate tissue correctly. Most of my atrophic scars are on my lower legs, and they're mostly self-inflicted. I'm not a cutter, but I do love to fuck with a bug bite, you know what I mean? Which is why you will sometimes these days catch me using deep wood off. Given the choice between DEET and low-key chronic self-harm, at some point in my 40s, I chose DEET. I hadn't noticed the scars until about then either. In most lights, they don't even show up on my pale-ass legs, but in other light, at a certain angle, you can see years' worth of dedicated effort. Two summers ago, I got a gnarly patch of like poison ivy or something on my leg just in time for the first Sunday of our summer camp series. It was very authentic. A nurse friend took a look at it and asked, "But why is it so deep?" And I could have said, "Because I've been preventing the skin from regenerating correctly." What I did say was, "I keep fucking with it." Most of my scars I caused myself, but not all of them. I was leading a storytelling workshop, leading an exercise that I used to lead a lot, mapping the stories that we carry in on our bodies. I have a flip chart on an easel and sort of unnecessarily would draw a stick figure, and then I would ask about the stories that people might have, like about when they first got eyeglasses or a particularly great kiss, about when they broke a bone, or what they inherited from one of their parents. And then, as I would approach the delta of the stick figure's legs, their crotch, I would say something light but sensitive about how some of us carry stories of sexual violence and how we should be gentle with ourselves. That day, meeting in a chapel, one woman spoke up. What if we don't have a story connected to like a particular part of our body? What if it has to do with our whole body? That's okay. I said, we're only just trying to come up with ideas. Do you have an example that you're willing to share with us? Well, for example, she said, "I'm fat." This group of like nine women almost gasped that dirty word. It was dirty in that little chapel, but in reality, it's just descriptive, right? And in that room, it wasn't even an accurate description. This person who spoke was quite petite, I bit my tongue and found the thing to say that wasn't, "Don't say that," or "No, you're not," which I could feel, you know, just under the surface of the room, all of us. And instead, I said, "When did you find out you were fat?" And suddenly, I could remember when I found out. The fourth grade hallway where one minute I was basking in sunlight, wearing my Easter dress turned school dress, and the next minute there was Tara O'Donnell at the end of the hallway, mimicking me with a kind of rolling walk I didn't recognize as my own. And then, in the next instant, I did. There I am, a little barrel in lavender and ruffles. I remembered the doctor warning my mother that if she wasn't careful, I'd end up housebound by my weight and immobile. I remembered my mother choosing to tell me that, a sixth grader of average size. I remembered all of the doctors, not just the ones who wanted to discuss my weight, whether I was there for a cold or literally anything else, but the really shitty doctors, the ones who handled my body without care, who handled my self without care, and left me with scars you can see and scars you can't. And for a long time, I blamed myself for those scars. I would apologize explicitly or not that I'm so sensitive. I'm just embarrassed that I would cry in doctor's offices, ashamed that I'm like this. I'm so sorry that I'm like this. With the exception of very minor lesions, every wound results in some degree of scarring. Scarring begins immediately after trauma. First, there's blood clotting, almost right away. For one or two days, then some other stuff happens involving macrophages, but I didn't want to pretend I know what that was or research it. Next comes the phase of increased blood flow. It supplies the traumatized area with more of what it needs to heal. That's called granulation. If the damaged tissue is a part of the body that had a lot of blood flow before the trauma, that's helpful. Tissues that don't have a lot of blood flow, apparently like tendons and ligaments, they take longer to heal. Movement is helpful, although scar tissue can still be easily damaged. The third phase is that new building blocks for healing start getting laid down faster. Fibroblasts and ground substance and collagen, the scar tissue starts to get stronger, less prone to injury. And the last phase is maturation. The collagen solidifies and shrinks, and if the scar is near a joint, it can make movement tricky or tight. In the bodies we show up with, most of us, the fiber of our tissues and muscles, those fibers are all lined up, all going in the same direction. Scar tissue, though, grows. It gets laid down across the wound like a patch, and the fibers end up kind of disorganized and crosshatched. That makes scar tissue strong and also less flexible. Scar tissue is connective tissue. If you drew a stick figure of Ibram Kendi, that Ibram Kendi, how to be an anti-racist, Ibram Kendi, if you drew a stick figure of him before 2020, he might have demurred if you asked what stories he had. Or he might have said, as a black man in America, that he had stories connected to his whole body. But in 2020, when Chadwick Boseman died after privately fighting colon cancer for 4 years, Kendi was ready to talk about the scars he carried. He too had had colon cancer. He too had kept it private. For a while, he said, he wondered not why it was happening to him, but why he had done it to himself, the cancer. He thought about symptoms he had ignored, thought about how he'd let his healthy lifestyle pass for taking his health seriously. Now he's cancer-free and has a long scar running across his belly, which I've seen, because there's a big article in GQ about it. Because he decided the thing to do after Boseman died was to show it, to be vulnerable, to encourage other folks to fight for their health, to end his own self-loathing, and to consider his scars as second birthmarks. Because after all, he is not dead. He is alive. Bodily perfection is important in the Hebrew scriptures in a way that I find very difficult to care about. I'm happy to dismiss anything about skin eruptions or leprous diseases or unclean flesh or reddish-white diseased spots on the bald head or the bald forehead. That's all Leviticus, obviously. I'm very happy to dismiss all of that as an ancient people trying to keep their community healthy and safe. It's hard for me to understand at a visceral level, therefore, the kind of shock and disgust that I may be supposed to feel reading about God's servant who was described as so marred in appearance, beyond human semblance, that nations and rulers are startled and then stunned into silence. It's hard for me to feel at a visceral level the shock and disgust that I may be supposed to feel reading about God's servant despised and rejected by others, a person of suffering, acquainted with illness, from whom others had to hide their faces. Hard to access the shock and disgust I may be supposed to feel reading about this disgusting one who turns out to be God's chosen, the righteous one of God. This is in the middle of the book of Isaiah. The prophet describing an unknown figure in language some of us recognize most easily from Handel's Messiah. This is the prophet describing an unknown figure who some have taken to be a stand-in for God's people Israel. An unknown figure who some take to be a stand-in for an individual, maybe Moses, maybe the prophet who's speaking. An unknown figure who some, especially around this time of year, take to be Jesus, oppressed and afflicted, taken away by a perversion of justice, although, you know, that could describe a lot of people. This one was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon this one was the punishment that made us whole, and by this one's bruises we are healed. The whole passage is called the Suffering Servant Song, and it's difficult, full stop, to translate, to interpret, to understand at a visceral level. But among the possibilities of meaning is the idea that God's work of bearing away the hurt and wrongdoing and death-dealing and shame and pain of many is the work of those with histories of being outcasts and despised. It is the work of those considered unfit to serve, much less to save. This past summer, I finally went to a dermatologist to establish, like, my baseline, you know, to assess my sort of starting point, like any moles that I have as they are now and not as they are yet to become, that kind of thing. And this doctor pored over my body, including separating my toes, which is very emotionally uncomfortable. And as she looked at my legs, I couldn't prevent myself from saying, well, I'm a picker, obviously. No shame here, she said immediately. No shame. And I heard in her tone, we don't do that here. The way she said no shame here made me think that she must say it all the time to all of us going in there with our private eruptions, the things that we've done to ourselves, the things that have been done to us. She can't even see it all. But all the stuff we think is just us, uniquely horrible, making us unfit. What she does see, I mean, I imagine that she can make sense of it. She sees the story in the scar, the laparoscopic surgeries, the self-harms, the wounds cross-hatched over, all that connective tissue. 650 years, give or take, after the prophet Isaiah's words got written down about a suffering servant, a person took a chariot home toward Ethiopia from Jerusalem, Ethiopia where they served in the court of the queen, a eunuch who'd been in Jerusalem for worship. A eunuch, an outsider in Jerusalem by race and ethnicity and gender. A eunuch who, according to Hebrew scriptures, needed to be kept separate, you know, for the health and safety of the community. Because a eunuch was so disfigured, that dirty word, eunuch, that in reality is a descriptive word with a role and an identity and royal responsibilities. And as the chariot rolled on, kicking up dust, the eunuch was reading the prophet Isaiah. And suddenly, here comes this guy running along the side of the chariot. Do you understand what you're reading? He kind of hollers up over the edge of the chariot. Is that Isaiah? And the eunuch is like looking for a conversation partner, and he invites the guy up into the chariot. And the eunuch keeps reading from Isaiah, like a sheep, he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. And I wonder if it was difficult for them, the eunuch, to understand at a visceral level that passage. And I'm going to speculate that no, it was not, because what they said next was, about whom, can I ask you, about whom do you think the prophet is saying this, himself or somebody else? And Philip, that was the guy caught up with a chariot. Philip didn't talk about the unknown figure or the history of interpretation of the passage. Instead, he told him about the good news of Jesus, who was a healer, who was a human, who was executed, who on the third day, spoiler, was raised, but still had wounds, still had scars. By his bruises, by his wounds, we're healed. We are freed to speak about our own words. No wounds, no shame. Those men in the GQ piece with Ibram Kendi, they have a huge range of feelings about their scars, what they mean. But all of them, six men besides Kendi, were game to share, hoping to get the word out about a disease that disproportionately takes African-American men too soon. Some of the men have keloid scars, big and bubbling. One guy has a colostomy bag now. A couple of guys have ports for their ongoing chemo treatment. And they each feel to one extent or the other like they're in the to-be-continued part of their lives. They're not dead yet. They've got the scars to prove it. There are all kinds of scars. The ones we cause ourselves or others. The ones that are inflicted on us by surgeries or by violence, by systems, by family and strangers. There are, depending who you ask and what article you look at, 3, 4, 6 different types of scars. Atrophic, hypertrophic, keloid, stretch marks are regarded by some as scars. And one more, the scar from which comes all the others, the idea of which was totally new to me and made me cry. A belly button is a scar. It starts to heal immediately after the umbilical cord is cut. A scar that was done to each of us, including Jesus. Many years ago, I had a dream with a bunch of the regular weird dream shit that didn't make any sense, including that I was teaching a yoga class, deeply unlikely. And toward the end of the dream, I was in the front of the room, and we knew that a flood was rising outside. And the water eventually seeped into the room, and I was laying on a low platform at the front of the class, and the water came in and kept rising. And instead of feeling fear, I thought, I have this body, I've used it up, and it's okay. And I turned my head toward the water. What happened to you is not okay. I'm sorry it happened to you. I'm sorry you have to carry it with you. And as soon as it happened, however imperfectly, you began to heal. It's not God's will for you to suffer, but it is God's will for you when you do, that scar tissue will immediately begin to grow and protect you, that connective tissue tying you to one another.